This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
This is Matt Kennedy, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
To Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry. This is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 101 for December 29th, 2020. The last episode of 2020. Released on the 130th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Massacre. If you don't know what that is, I'll leave a link in the show notes. But to me, there's not a more fitting time to have the last episode of this shitty year. I mean, for me personally, it's been good in some ways, especially for this podcast. But it's just been painful to go through. Aside from some difficult personal change, you know, what all of us are experiencing, which is a massacre of different sorts, really just breaks my heart that we've lost so many people in this past year, and largely just due to selfishness and carelessness. I wish more of us cared more about each other and weren't so self-centered that we walk around possibly infecting each other with this virus. Had a good Christmas. Hope you did too. But, you know, I was running around on Christmas Eve, picking up some last minute stuff. I was taking food to some family who I was hoping to spend Christmas Eve with, but I couldn't because they were kind of quarantining, not sure if they had been exposed to the virus. And so instead of taking food and having food with them, I just dropped it off. And on the way there, I stopped at Whole Foods just to pick up a couple last minute things to take to them. And as I'm walking in the door, I see this young woman who is, you know, kind of stationed at the front door, and she's handing a mask to a guy who didn't have one. And, you know, this is someone who's probably paid not much more than minimum wage, who is tasked with confronting people who don't care, you know, whether or not they expose someone to this, or they have their own ideas about whether or not they should wear a fucking mask, which just infuriates me. So, you know, I see this girl hand this guy who's probably 35 years old. He's coming in by himself on Christmas Eve, and she hands him this mask, and I kind of make my way around the store and pick up what I need, and I see him again, and there he is walking around with no fucking mask on Christmas Eve. The store is packed full of people, middle of the afternoon, and to me, it just kind of was emblematic of what we've seen all year round with this pandemic. You know, whether masks actually help or not, whether you think they help or not, why wouldn't we wear a fucking mask if it would save someone's life? If it might save someone's life. And I've already done an episode where I kind of went on a little bit of a jag about this mask thing, but reminded me of how disappointing this year has been to me. And if for no other reason, because so many people have acted out of selfishness with so much at risk. And at this point, you know, we've lost already 300,000 American citizens to this illness and seem to be numb to it, largely. So anyway, yeah, I'm pretty pleased that this year is coming to a close. I'm ready for a new one. Thanks a lot for listening this year. I got a lot of ideas about what I want to do next, and about how to improve this podcast. You got some great guests coming up, and this is part two with Matt Kennedy, who's the owner and director of Gallery 30 South in Pasadena, California. And, you know, we just kind of pick up where we left off, and Matt just kind of touches on all sorts of things, and I just really appreciate him taking part in this. And, you know, all the guests who've been a part of this podcast in 2020, all of you who have listened, I appreciate it. Please keep coming around. And, you know, my commitment to you is to keep trying to improve this thing. And it's been a really good year. So thanks again. Episode 101. Hope you enjoy it. Matt Kennedy.
I have massive respect for screen printing. You know, we have an artist that we'll be showing next month who's his main thing is screen printing, and there are pieces that have 30 screens on one piece because he's made a separate screen for every tattoo that he's put up and down, like, you know, a tattooed sleeve on, you know, a pop culture character. So, you know, that's a really, you know, neat kind of way of taking an obsessive way of looking at something, which is generally seen as an addition. Mm-hmm. You know, when we did a project for the Panic Collective, we did these abstracted album covers, and we did them, you know, almost 5 feet by 5 feet, to basically 120 centimeters by 120 centimeters. And we did it because that was, the same, size that, the German abstract, expressionist painter, Gerhard Richter, the same size that he did a series in. Mm-hmm. So we're like, he's fine art. This is the size he does. We'll do that size. And so I would take an album cover and I would, in Photoshop, change it into an abstracted version of that image. And then I would send that image to another Panic Collective member. And they wouldn't necessarily know what it was an image of. So they would try and paint that abstracted digital image, and then they would send it back to me. And sometimes it would come back a little too clean. So I would then go at it, and I would start chipping away at it with alkyds and, you know, abrasives, and make it a little bit more abstract, you know, kind of mess it up a little bit more. And then sometimes we would send that back to a lab to photograph, and then I would have that photograph printed in China on canvas, and then have that sent. So it was sort of a comment on Jackson Pollock never touching the canvas. It's a very different way of not touching the canvas, but still being the creator of the work. And the idea of artistic telephone, that, you know, we whisper in class in each other's ears, and by the time you get from one desk in the corner all the way around the classroom to the other desk, it's a completely different sentence. And that appealed to me, that it becomes a collaboration that becomes itself. And, you know, when I would do pottery and ceramics, I would love when they would come out of the kiln just completely messed up. You know, like the kiln got too hot and it started to crack and it did this weird stuff, and it no longer looked like the perfect version of what that was supposed to be. And that to me is where, you know, my collaborator is nature and my collaborator is technology, that I don't have control over that, you know, that I don't want to have control over that. There's nothing fun about that. In a way, there's really nothing fun about doing anything perfectly well. I mean, like if I was Neil Peart and I'm a drummer and I'm the best drummer in the world and playing a perfect set night after night, I don't think he would be able to do that without doing some kind of ad lib that he can do that doesn't mess up the rest of the band. I think that, you know, there has to be that element of improvisation or you go crazy. And, you know, I think that if you're going to live long in the arts, then you have to have fun with it. Even if it's your main job, if it's your business, if it's, you know, the thing that's paying your bills, and some people feel like they have to stop having fun and they have to get serious about it. I think they completely missed the point of why they became an artist, if that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that if you do allow for that improvisation, you do allow for imperfection, you'll get much more interesting work. But you still have to care about it too. You know, like if you're known as a technical painter, you can't completely slack and no longer paint technically, and still be necessarily as successful. But you may get more joy out of doing that, and that joy may be more important to you than the amount of money you make. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of artists, it seems like painting exactly what they want to paint is much more important than having a long career. Right. And, you know, and those types of decisions can end a career really short, you know, can be a very premature ending. There's a lot of people that went to art school, probably paid $260,000 for their education, did a couple of shows, had a couple of failures, and now they do something else for a living. And that to me is heartbreaking. Mm. And I think that that comes out of the fact that they didn't take off enough time in between semesters. So they didn't get a real chance to absorb what they just learned and figure out if they like it or hate it before they move on to the next thing that they have to learn to get a grade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people forget that you go to school to learn something, not necessarily for the degree of the diploma. I do not have, you know, a diploma from beyond high school. I've been to college, but I didn't graduate with a diploma because I ended up working. Right. And as I got older, I'm like, oh, you know, if I'm going to get one of those institutional jobs, I'm going to need a master's degree. I should have gone to school. And then I think, but when would I have gone? You know, if I had continued going, then I would have missed all that great time in the early 90s I had hanging out with William Burroughs and Genesis Peoridge and, you know, the guys in Guns N' Roses, you know, and stuff like that. You know, and okay, if I had done it in that next, you know, 4 or 5 years later, then I wouldn't have gone to Japan. I wouldn't, you know, have had one of the best relationships, you know, I've ever had in my life. You know, if I had put it off another 5 years, what happens? You know, it's like, you know, people say this about, you know, having kids, I guess. I do not have kids, but they say, you know, if you wait until it's the right time, you never do. I guess that's maybe why I don't. Right. But in a way, you know, my children are, and not in a dismissive way, but, you know, a lot of the sort of strong relations I have, mentoring relationships that I have, which would ostensibly have been with a child, have been with the artists that I've shown. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's, that to me is the reward. It's more important to me. You know, like I can, the idea is there that if I need to go do an art fair, I can do an art fair, you know, and now that I'm back in entertainment, there's a little bit more of a limit on that. But again, it's, to me, it's all the same thing. It's, you know, releasing good movies and great packaging and doing a great job with the features and cleaning up the master. That's all, that's an art form too. And, you know, you want great cinema and even films that not everybody considers great to be arguable as being great, you know, and being presented in that type of conversation. It's like, hang that on a wall. You know, it's right. A big screen television set. You know, it's picture tells 1,000 words. What's a movie tell you?
So it sounds like this has been a pretty satisfying life for you doing this kind of work.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of regrets. I've got small regrets. None of them are really even worth mentioning. You know, it's like, should I have done this instead of doing that? On occasion, absolutely. I mean, the things that I regret is if I said something really unkind to someone. That to me is regretful. You know, I said that the idea of me having patience would have made my mother laugh. You know, I certainly was very impatient and I wasn't necessarily the kindest person in the room when I was younger. And I had a major chip on my shoulder and there's a lot of reasons for that. But at a certain point, I just got over it. You know, I just kind of like, and not everybody can, you know, that's not a privilege that everybody has. And I understand that, you know, I'm not, could I have done that if I had been a woman as easily as I did? I don't know. I have been able to do that necessarily if I had been a minority? I'm doubtful. I don't know. Or, you know, there's all kinds of different mindsets that you can bring to it. So I consider myself extremely privileged, you know, that I can even have the kind of cavalier ability to say, oh, I wish I could have done that differently. You know, like, because it was actually an option that I could have taken. Right. You know, a lot of people don't even have those options and the roadmap is written and maybe they don't even realize it's written. I think the people that do are the people that are, you know, kind of rising up and saying, hey man, this isn't cool. Yeah. And, you know, power to them for doing that. You know, it's, there's a lot of people that don't know that don't understand, you know, how all the pieces on the board are already in place. And some people have had a long ability to be able to navigate that better than others. And I know that I'm completely aware of it. I don't feel guilty for it, but I do understand that it is a privilege that I have that not everybody does. You know, I'm a guy named Kennedy. When I'm in Florida, when Ted Kennedy was alive, I would walk into any restaurant I wanted to eat in and I would say, I think my uncle has a reservation here. And they would say, what is your name? And I would say, my name is Matt Kennedy. And I would get a good seat and I didn't necessarily have to wear a tie, you know, and all that stuff. So, you know, the truthfulness of that statement never came into accord. You know, and I think that, you know, food cheated tastes twice as good as food earned, I guess you could say. But just as I guess money won is supposedly better than money earned. I don't know. I like money earned.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about and something that I think if I were to spend too much time thinking about it, the process of thinking about it would bum me out more so than the possibilities.
Well, you know, you touched on a lot of stuff here that, you touched on mentorship, you know, which to me is, very satisfying and something that's really important to me to be able to pass down what I've learned. And you know, I just have this desire to do it and, you know, I care. So, so that's important to me. You know, also collaboration, you know, part of the reason I'm doing this podcast, and the website and featuring artists. I mean, I think I said this to you in one of our other conversations. I just feel lucky that, you know, I have these artists giving me images of their work and I can put it on a website. And, you know, it's one of those things where it helps them and it helps me. Hopefully it helps them. You know, that's the goal for me, besides just doing something meaningful and worthwhile. But that's what this whole project is to me, is it's one big collaboration that I get to kind of curate, you know?
Yep.
And it's a blast. I love it.
It's a mixtape, you know, like what was ever more fun than making a mixtape?
Yeah.
You know, you put a lot, if you like, maybe some people don't put any thought into it, I don't know. But like, I used to agonize. I still agonize over it. You know, like the best and worst thing that ever happened was playlists in iTunes, you know, and now you've got like even better, you know, for that ability is something like Spotify. But, you know, the fact that the artists don't get probably paid what they should is a whole other issue. And so I don't want to make heroes out of the Spotify folks. But the apparatus by which you have, you know, this incredible, ridiculous library of music at your fingertips to be able to assemble your own order of hearing and experiencing songs. And then for it to make recommendations based on algorithms around genre and beat per minute, the types of instrumentation is incredible. I mean, we just never had this before. And I think it actually makes things a little bit better. I'm not a guy who hates new technology at all. I embrace it when I can. But, you know, I still also love boomboxes and I still love cassette tapes and I still will make a playlist on iTunes and then I will make a cassette out of that sometimes because I love the idea of a side break, which you no longer have, right?
Right.
So like you got to collect those Maxell, you know, 120, you know, type two metal cassettes to get, you know, an hour on each side.
No idea what we're talking about here.
His sidebar, the micro cassette.
Well, you know, and that's something I used, you know, back in my reporting days. I covered some high school sports and I would record my interviews with the little micro cassette player. I'd take it with me and then, you know, transcribe it when I got back to the paper. But
I used to do that all the time too. I'd actually interview people in bars to show them, you know, how ridiculous they got when they were drunk.
Oh, man.
You know, I would just like, and I mean, I was drinking too. I'm not above them. I'm no better than they were, you know, but you'd start taping these conversations. You listen to them later and just people would cringe. And it was such a great lesson. You
know? Yeah, I'm sure. Well, there's probably some video of me out there somewhere that I don't want to see.
I'm old enough that, that didn't become too much of an issue, you know.
They had to have camcorders back then, you know, when the time
nobody had them.
Nope, that's
it. Yeah.
It wasn't like everybody had a device that they were holding in their hand. I mean, this is coming back a ways, but thank God, you know, I couldn't imagine living, you know, that way with all this. I mean, it's just crazy. The world is in our lifetimes because we're close to the same age. Everything's just changed so much. It really has.
Yeah. Well, you just touched on something though too, right? So, you know, the fact that that technology is out there, this is something that I feel like, you know, the generation before ours couldn't feel anything. They couldn't have any emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And so we being the youngest of that older generation and the siblings of that older generation, we were raised the same way. So while our friends might have been able to possibly like talk back to their parents or had no problems crying or things, not clean the plate. Yep. Or crying or any of that stuff. Like that was never an option for me or for anybody in my family. We're all like really sort of tightly wound in a lot of ways. And, you know, and I certainly broke at a certain point, you know, it's like I was wound way too tight and I broke. And to be a kid today with all of that additional pressure of the amount and ease of public shaming, you know, of the expectation of this artificial life that one lives, you know, through social media where the main character in this fictional story is you and being of an age where you don't necessarily understand the differences of where the real you is and this other character stops. Like kids have it, you know, way tougher, you know, like in some ways that, you know, life is a little bit easier. You know, in general, life is a little bit easier, but I don't think it's ever been tougher to be a kid and especially tougher than it is being a teenager.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that those are the years that really kind of decide what the rest of your life is going to be. You know, you always have a chance to kind of stop and reassess, hopefully, and make better decisions and, you know, turn from being, you know, a not so great person into a much better person. Like I say, you know, I haven't always been the best person in the room, you know, and the two things that I really struggle with is in being happy for other people's success if I don't like that person. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's anybody that I know that I like, I'm thrilled when they succeed at even the most minor things. And even if they post about it relentlessly, I don't hold it against them. I understand that that is part of the process. I don't become bothered by it. It's not this pesky thing. But, you know, I still try and just be like, you know what, good for them. You know, this person who maybe I don't like, you know, maybe this will make them a better person. That is something that I endeavor to feel and to believe. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I was younger and I kind of was a bit more cavalier about how I felt about things and things that I would say. But, you know, now you can't do that. You can't have the luxury of those mistakes. You know, like we've gone through a lot of, you know, Senate subcommittees on behavior. Yeah. And all these people are old enough that they are just so lucky that they can sit in a room and say, nope, that never happened. Nope. Yeah. Nope. Never did that. Nope. Never drank a beer. You know, like they can all say this stuff and everybody knows it's bullshit, but there's no proof. Mm. Now, any generation, anybody who's about 30 years old at this point, that shit's out there. You know, that evidence is there. It can't be hidden. It exists. You know, what it would cost to scrub the internet to get rid of that stuff. Certainly, you know, the Chris Gaines footage is gone for Garth Brooks, so I know it's possible. But, you know, that there's, the trouble you have to go through to remove even the most minor mistakes, you know, from every possible outlet is impossible. So you have to, this generation in a good way, maybe just has to get comfortable with, you know, embracing the truth and saying, you know what, I did that and that was stupid. Yeah. And I'm going to learn from that.
It might be good. Like you say, it might actually be a good thing.
I hope so. You know, but it's, I just feel like, you know, will the next generation be so holier than thou as we've seen, you know, in a way? Because the other side of that coin of these guys lying about stuff that they've clearly done is holding somebody for a lifetime accountability for something that wasn't necessarily a crime at the time, that was even common, still inappropriate, but not seen as inappropriate as it is now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not excusing, you know, how barbaric, you know, it was. Look at a teen sex comedy from the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that.
I'm with you. But, you know,
that's the general public. But that's the public attitude right there.
It is definitely. Yeah. But to me, I think when you're a human being who can accept responsibility for what you did wrong and have the humility to say it.
Yep.
And to own, listen, I'm a better person now than I was then. I did stupid shit and I'm not proud of it. But instead, you know, you have, I'm thinking in the context of politicians, you know, you have them, you know, avoiding saying things because they don't want it to become a soundbite or, you know, I mean, but I really do think, you know, if you're coming from the right place and you're willing to apologize and accept responsibility for what you did and you can be sincere, I think people generally accept that, you know?
Yeah. You know what I think the problem has been is that we haven't seen that sincerity yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing that really jumps to mind is Brett Kavanaugh, right? You know, Brett Kavanaugh and that whole hearing. The Matt Damon sketch. So, you know, if 15 years before he was nominated for the Supreme Court, if while he was a superior court judge, in one of the largest courts in the country, if one day he had woken up and been like, wow, you know what? I should probably find that person I was really shitty to a long time ago and just like go apologize. And maybe they're not going to accept my apology, but I want to go and do that. Mm-hmm. If that had ever happened, she never would have come out again.
Right.
15 years later, because she would have had her closure. She would have seen like, wow, this guy who did this terrible thing, you know, to whatever degree, it occurred, has shown a regret for it, an honest regret. And that doesn't usually happen in life. And that would probably be the end of it. And then if he became during the nomination, if it came up, he could say, I, as a person of my era, I acted a certain way, and I think I went above and beyond, or below and beyond, as the case may be, what would have been acceptable behavior that time. And I've wrestled with that, and I reached out to that person and apologized. I carried such a great guilt, and I carry a shame for it now. But I hope that has led me to be able to make better decisions and to be a much more compassionate judge,
right?
Because that's what I do, you know, but we haven't seen anything like that yet. You know, I think that what has happened is that we've seen terrible people pick terrible people. I think he's going to turn out to be a much more liberal voice in the Supreme Court than I think was estimated. Yeah. But, and let's not forget that he was a judge in Washington, D.C., you know, so right. It's kind of like, you know, even if you're a little conservative in D.C., you're still pretty far left of most of the rest of the country. So that may, you know, grow to bite the party that put him in place in the butt, so to speak. But, you know, maybe we'll see it. Maybe we'll see, you know, a great apology and a great forgiveness. I've seen it in Hollywood. You know, I've seen people that I didn't feel should apologize for anything give the best apologies I've ever seen. And I've seen unrelenting scumbags hold their positions for decades. So it's kind of like the best and the worst of it, you know, in a stretch of area, you know, that's 25 minutes by car from where I'm standing right now. Mm. But, you know, if we see it in the political arena, I think that will reflect in the fabric of society. And I hope that we see that shortly. You know, I hope that just having the president of the United States wearing a mask will encourage people to wear a mask. You know, just the fact that he's wearing it, even if they hate his guts, even if, you know, they, you know, are QAnon lunatics, that they, you know, they see this person who is the leader of the free world enacting a certain degree of care, that maybe they should do that too. And I hope that little things like that bring us a little bit back towards, you know, a kinder society than what we've seen. But I also think that, you know, that kind of, you're not allowed to do anything wrong culture has kind of put that reaction in place too. And, you know, it's difficult for me in California to be able to even say stuff like that. You know, and I do believe, you know, I consider myself to be rather liberal, you know, I would practically a communist, you know, but I'm still, you know, too far right from, you know, some people have really, really, I think, dangerous and bad ideas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's got to be some area in the middle. And I mean, I'm the guy that had the People's Prison show, you know, like where we had a Donald Trump impersonator in a cage in my gallery, you know, and in the surrounding neighborhoods, you know, outside of Pasadena. Pasadena is pretty blue, but not entirely. And you go over a couple of cities and it gets pretty red. And then Orange County, of course, just kind of flip back a little bit red again. But I think a lot of that is reaction against, you know, didn't we all used to hate censorship?
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't say certain things. Sure. You should be held accountable for what you say. Absolutely. But you shouldn't go to jail for speaking your mind on an opinion, you know? And, you know, I think that because everything got pushed around so crazy, that's why we've got, you know, the ludicrous amounts of conspiracy theories that pop up, because it's, you know, it's the breeding ground for it now.
Yeah, man, we could go on and on. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about, I think the kids are actually what's going to save all this. I really
I hope so.
I really do think that you know, it's getting better. And, you know, did you see the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speech on the House floor in response to the other congressman from Florida calling her a fucking bitch? Did you see
that? Oh, that was amazing. Yeah, that was amazing.
And you know what? She was real.
Yeah.
And he made a lame ass apology that was not even an apology.
Yep.
And she gave it right back to him and
she lit him up. Yeah. And it was amazing.
Completely appropriate. I mean, there was nothing attacking about, you know, she was just speaking the truth.
Yeah.
And standing up for herself. And I mean, she's to me like such a bright light and breath of fresh air because she's sincere and real.
Yeah.
And you know, and these, you know, guys are, I mean, I've seen signs that say, you know, make Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a bartender again. You know, I mean, they should maybe have a
bigger impact on the culture in certain areas in that capacity. Yeah.
They poke fun at her when really she is the embodiment of what the American dream is supposed to be.
Oh, absolutely.
And they make fun of her and she's not having it. I just think it's to me that gives me hope. And also being a guy who lives in Florida, seeing the kids from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting and what they did in response to that was just inspiring to me, you know.
But yeah, when, you know, you sent the questionnaire out and it's like, you know, who's somebody you respect? And like the first person that popped into my head is Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
And it's like, I just have incredible respect for the intensity of young people. And, you know, and you can break it down and say, well, it's easy to be ideal when you don't have the same amount of real world problems that you have as an adult. You know, it's like, you know, you become saddled with the actual financial expense of making decisions. Mm. And, you know, and in a way it's like, while I have incredible respect for her, you know, I have to think like, it's got to be somewhat difficult for her parents, you know, to be the parents of this famous, right. You know, world famous child. And, you know, they can't eat meat anymore.
I mean,
you can't be Greta's
said,
dad and eat meat
anymore.
And wear leather and, you know, that stuff. So it's a family affair. I mean, it does take a village to raise a child in a lot of ways. And I think that idealism is great. And I love seeing it. It's a great documentary on her. That's, might be on Hulu or something now,
yeah,
but, it ends with all these other kids, you know, kids younger than her, you know, that are taking a massive stance on, you know, environmental causes and other causes. Mm. And then like, you know, that maybe it's the Libra in me that I have a great amount of respect for astrology, but, you know, it's as good or bad as any, you know, semi-classification system that we have about personality traits. Mm. But, I also have a kind of gawking respect for the audacity of people that just feel so righteous. Yeah. Like I always said, I'm really jealous of people that are very religious because I grew up Catholic and I hit a certain age and I'm like, this isn't for me, mm-hmm. You know? And I'm like, you can go so far with this. If you don't try and claim a scientific reality to an esoteric idea, then it goes a lot further. You know, it's like, I understand the principles of something like Buddhism, even if I'm not going to practice it, because mm-hmm. It's sort of like the God within, not the God without.
Right.
But, you know, to give human characteristics and this kind of Santa Claus, you know, personality to a deity is just a little weird to me. Like, I don't understand why it's a very, very popular idea. And I don't begrudge anybody who believes it if it makes them happy. But that's what I'm sort of jealous of, is that happiness that they have, this kind of oblivious happiness. I wish I could unknow whatever it is that I know that prevents me from believing something that is so foolish that would give me so much happiness. And I wish I could find a different type of foolishness that gave me that happiness. Hmm. So, you know, something maybe a little bit more plausible within my own dogma. But, you know, I still have, you know, I still have relatives who are very religious, and they vote based on these religious ideas.
Well, or they claim to, and they're actually voting in opposition to the religious ideals. If they're like,
oh yeah, there's that too. Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah. No, it's that they vote on the perfection of the idea, not in the actual practice of really believing.
Right.
So, you know, I get, you know, there are some people who are very pro-life, and, you know, I don't believe as they do, in where a life starts or not. Mm-hmm. Like I have a basic disagreement with them. But I understand that if they believe that, why they believe so strongly in it, and that they can't understand why I don't see that.
Right.
You know, so I that's an issue that you kind of have to agree to disagree about.
Right.
And then you have to say, okay, well, would you rather that a child be raised in an environment with people who don't want it, right, who treat it terribly, that almost guarantee that this child will not be given the right chances in life and can become actually a terrible individual themselves and repeat this cycle of unhappiness and possibly violence? And, you know, we saw crime rates go down basically exactly 19 years after Roe versus Wade. So you can make statistics about that. Violent crime went way down, but, you know, and then as abortions got more difficult to get, violent crime has been on the rise again. So, you know, that's a statistic that I pay attention to, because an unhappy teenager can take out a hell of a lot more people, you know, than an embryo. Mm. And, you know, so that to me becomes, you know, something that's a factor that I factor into why, you know, abortion doesn't bother me. But right, if that were my issue, there's one party that backs that issue.
Right.
And
right,
if that's the only issue that matters to you, you will close your eyes to every other issue.
Right.
So like, you know, do they all go to church every Sunday? Maybe not. You know, do they all, you know, do they never use the Lord's name in vain? Maybe not. You know, do they lie? Certainly. You know, it's like, you can run down the list of, you know, and, you know, the commandments and be like, okay, why is this even a commandment? Why is this thing in here twice? You know, like it's an interesting set of rules.
Well, you know, but honestly, I think a lot of this is just about people trying to feel better about themselves.
Yes.
And there's also an element of, I had to do it, why shouldn't you have to do it?
That's a big thing, you know, but I got to say, you know, it's again, another thing that I understand the unhappiness is the concept of unfairness, right? So you've heard this clown, you know, invoke how unfair everything is for him. It's like, what is unfair for a billionaire who was given his entire fortune?
More entitled human being in the
history of the world.
Yes.
You know, it's hard to figure out who that person could be if it is not he.
Right.
But that message resonates because the people that he's talking to have been treated unfairly at least once in their lives, maybe multiple times. And they have a comparative, sense of justice, you know. I kind of believe that my justice ends at my fingertips, you know, like not what they touch, but from my fingertips back into my body. That's my domain. Mm-hmm. Those are my rights. If you start getting dizzying up on my rights within there, then we have a problem. And I don't want to enforce any rights beyond where my fingertips are. So I think that if people agreed with that, I think that we'd probably all get along a little bit better, but we don't, because once upon a time, someone did, you know, knock them off the piano bench or whatever, and no one saw it, and that person denied it, and they were treated unfairly. I mean, you can get as petty with it, or you can get very serious with it. You can, you know, some people go to jail, other people don't go to jail. I mean, it's, you know, this is, everybody has been treated unfairly probably. But that notion of unfairness is a real thing. And so the getting around that, like how do you get back around that is difficult. I mean, like when I was in SAG, when I was in the Screen Actors Guild, there was this big push to join Drama League and this other union. It was like, their dues were a lot less than mine. And so, like, every actor was like, oh, we don't want to combine unions, not thinking of how much more power you have with a membership base that's basically three times the size of the one you have. But because it cost me $1,500 to join the union and it cost them like $250 and a handshake, right, every actor I knew was against it that was in the union, and every non-union actor was for it because they wanted a SAG card. Right. So it was all personal interest. None of it was about the power of the union.
That says a lot, doesn't it? I mean, you know, selfishness.
Yep. The greatest motivator of all time, you know? I mean, and you look at the artists who are very big now, right? And it's all, it's very much like, here I am. So like, when you look at graffiti, and, you know, I've got an artist in the walls who was a graffiti artist for a number of years, became a muralist. If, you know, you're allowed to put something on a wall, it's not graffiti, it's painting. And so it's funny when they say there's a graffiti art show down the street in a gallery. No, there isn't. But, you know, the idea, the motivating factors behind that have changed over time. You know, like the original graffiti was really not just political, but military. That there were words written on buildings to send a signal in the resistance.
Kilroy was
about
here.
What was going on. Yeah, Kilroy was here. Werewolves, like all that. So both sides. So the you know, graffiti has typically been used to tip off, you know, to send a message that's harder to see, you know, because it's against the blight. Not that there was a lot of writing on walls going on, you know, before a certain point in time. But that went from, hey, look, you know, here's this thing that's happening. Then it became, hey, look at the situation we live in. This is our plight. You know, here's my plight. And then it became, hey, look at me.
Here's my name.
Yep. And then it became, hey, I got a show down the street. You know, so it's kind of like it's leapfrogged from its original purpose and intent and incarnation into this very, very selfish thing. And so what's funny is that as it's become more selfish, it's become more embraced by society. Mm. Like, people don't mind graffiti as much as they minded it when it was somebody who had a legitimate gripe trying to show the world that something shitty was happening. Now it's like, hey, I can paint this. And here's my name is, you know, almost the size of the piece.
I never thought of that, but you're right. It's, yeah. I mean, it's really taboo when there was a purpose.
Yeah. You know, that's crazy, right? It's completely backwards. Yeah. But it's also this type of artwork is really interesting because graffiti art made critics of everybody, right? Like a bad graffiti gets painted over really quickly by other graffiti. Right. You know, sometimes good graffiti gets tagged, and that's shitty. Tagging is like the most selfish, most destructive form of graffiti, and I should know because I was a tagger. But, you know, and that whole thing was like, you know, I don't like that painting or I don't like that billboard. And that's what I would do. You know, I viciously attacked a Angeline billboard, you know, like 5-6 times in a row, and I won. They ended up taking it down and not putting it back up. I just thought it was so hideous, and it was inappropriately placed. It was not a good photo of her. Everything about it was terrible. And I actually I know Angeline somewhat well, and I do not like her, but I have a lot of respect for her in a weird way. That, you know, she is one of those people who is actually famous for nothing. And that takes a lot of effort. Huh. Like, that takes more effort than if you do something legitimately well. Yeah.
That has to be a lot of pressure, right?
I mean, she has to be that character for the rest, you know, she's been that character for a very long time. She has to be that character for the rest of her life. And nobody is a bigger protector of her image than she is. Mm-hmm. You know, even as she's violating, you know, what is appropriate by rolling up in a gallery and selling her stuff in somebody else's show to somebody, which will, you know, absolutely get her kicked out of a show. But like, I respect the hustle, and I, you know, but the billboard was aesthetically unpleasing, and it was directly across the street from like an elementary school. I just didn't like it. And I went up and I painted over it, you know, every other day because they kept fixing it. Like, I've never seen billboards get fixed so fast. Wow. And I was telling people that I did this, and I'd go show them and it was fixed, and I'm looking and they think I'm lying. Like, right. Oh, you didn't go do that. And I'm like, no, I was just there. And I'm like, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go right back. I'm going to go back to work. I'm going to get my overalls. I'm going to grab my ladder. I'm going to grab a bucket of paint. And I didn't do this with a spray can. I did it with a brush, wow. Which nobody graffitis like that. And would go back, and I would go up to the security guard that was at the base of this office building that this billboard was on. And I was like, I got to go back up and fix the sign. He's like, oh, I thought they were just here. I said, yeah, somebody hit it again. And then I would go up and I would hit it again. So this guy didn't even put two and two together that I was the person that kept going back there and re-graffiting it because I looked like I was supposed to be there. Hmm. And I was also, you know, a white blonde kid with blue eyes,
right?
You know, and you know, that didn't do me any disservice in that capacity, you know, which it would have been a whole different story if I was Latino or if I was black, you know, or if I was Asian, you know, in 1991, I think it was. So it's like that. It was a privilege for me to be able to take this, you know, opinion about aesthetic to the next level by defacing a paid for billboard, which is destruction of private property and rightfully carries a sentence of going to jail. But on the flip side of that, isn't an advertisement graffiti? Like if mm-hmm. I'm driving down the street and somebody is paid to put something so that I see it to try and influence my opinion, isn't that an invasion of my mm-hmm. brain? You know, like that to me is worse on some level. And so the only way I can fight back against that psychological warfare of them trying to push whatever crappy product it is, maybe even a good product. But the fact that I have no say over what they're trying to push because I have to get from point A to point B, and that's the only way to get there. So in a way, it's like, what's the real graffiti here? You know, like
right.
Washington, D.C. has no billboards. There are no billboards in Washington, D.C. Lady Bird Johnson, you know, made it her campaign to get all the billboards out of D.C. And I wish that was a more common thing. But now billboards have become, and especially oddly, Angeline's billboard became very iconic to the city of Los Angeles. Her original billboard was great. The kind of like weird, creepy old lady, big boob Lolita thing that she had up became this oddly iconic thing about Los Angeles. And in many ways, it is the epitome of Los Angeles in 1985 or 86. But these other billboards were god awful. They were terrible. And, you know, so there's every way you can look at something, there's an opinion there, and there's probably some validity to that opinion. And so the way that we argue it has moved into this kind of act of terrorism, right? Like where we're enforcing, you know, our ideas on people constantly. And this has kind of exploded into a situation where those opinions have become watered down and more palatable and therefore tolerable and therefore enjoyed. And now people walk down the street and they see, you know, some graffiti painting on the side of a building and they think, I can do better than that. And so that kid learns some skills and he gets to be able to draw a little bit better. Or I really, really hate that. And then they start going in the opposite direction and they start tackling maybe more high-minded art. But, you know, because it's on display, because it is now everywhere, it's now more of a possibility. And if you take that comparison, if you move that to a different society, and you say, go to Japan, where they have such massive respect for illustrators, where everybody reads comics. And my wife and I were talking today. She was like, hey, do Americans have comics about, you know, chefs? And I was like, no, like that's just not a thing. And she was like, yeah, you know, like 10 years ago, there was a whole bunch of these like cooking comic books in Japan. And I was like, there should be cooking comics in America. They should be very popular. You know, they should be like, you know, newspaper strips are like web exclusives that pop up once a week on, you know, whatever site, whether it's Mary Claire or, you know, like, Blender or something.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the fact that society grew up with illustration everywhere, with billboards everywhere, and they're a society that respects illustration, that respects, you know, sequential art. Maybe as we get young people more accustomed to seeing art in daily lives, that it creates more of an opportunity for that. And I think that while we may not be seeing it in the fine art world, I think that has become a fifth pillar. You know, that the only way to escape poverty for years was three things, right? It was like sports, college, or music. Well, now there's sports, college, music, TikTok, and art. You know, it's like TikTok, there's two other, now there's gaming is now a sport, you know, like, so there are these other possibilities where you don't need to have paid a fortune for an education to have a roadmap for being able to survive, you know, for the rest of your life, you know, to live and have a family. It's more expensive, of course, but there's more aspiration. So I think that there will be an explosion of people who want to pursue the arts in some capacity, whether they want to design video games and they'll learn how to do that, or whether they're going to be, you know, working in animation, which has become much more affordable and easier to do, and a fairly profitable industry as well, because the costs have come down. So that those kids that by seeing, you know, even tags, you know, and, you know, unsanctioned artwork in places, have seen a kind of rock star in their neighborhood, in their midst. And what's even better is that nobody usually knows who they are. So, like, by being anonymous and being a graffiti artist, you're kind of a real badass. You know, you're like a bank robber. And, but, you know, a folk bank robber, not like the guy that kills everybody in the bank, you know, so there's a certain amount of prestige. And in America, we have always had respect for the bad guy in a weird way. You know, like, we have made heroes out of terrible people. Not in the classic way, you know, not even that we lie. Like, we don't say, oh, that's Jesse James. He was really, really a great guy. You know, it's like, no, we know he was a murderer. Right. But we have respect for him because he was famous. That's the only thing he accomplished was fame. So he became an icon. And this seems to be really only a thing in cultures that came out of England. You know, so it's Australia settled by prisoners, right? So they have, like, really interesting respect for outlaws there. We won't talk about the similar problem that they had with indigenous people, but, you know, certainly terrible situations happened. America, you know, like, we've also always had kind of a respect for the bad guy, and not necessarily even the underdog, but the bad guy.
Right.
You know, and it's, you know, it's carried through in our love of sports.
Probably. And look at the president. I mean, you know,
yeah,
he's not, I mean, a
is
good
this
guy.
The, I mean, the Nadir,
no,
you know,
it's about it. You know?
Is this what we've, is it the Nadir? Like, I hope it's a weird kind of blip of, oh my God, we went really, really low on that. And I hope that, you know, that some level-headed people latch onto a couple of his platforms and do good with it instead of just making more division, because there are real things, you know, there were real issues, you know, there are problems with immigration. You know, and it's a really complicated problem.
Group of people who feel voiceless. That's he did, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
what we realize, of course, is they had nothing to say because they have nothing to think. But, you know, that's why they had no voice in a weird way. But he did shine a light on some things, but they're all like, you know, the Band-Aid for the bullet hole can't be the solution that we have for everything. You know, it's, why haven't we solved immigration? Because it's complicated. Right. It's a tough thing. You know, it's like, you know, I love political art, and we've showcased a lot of it here. People don't buy it. Nobody buys political art. You know, this is the 8th year that we've done the Coaster Show, you know, the show where Alana sold all 10 of her pieces. And on the last day of the show, like, they hadn't sold. And then on the last day of the show, one piece sold, and then two sold, and then three sold, and then two and two, like, they went, you know, and it was like all in rapid succession. And that's kind of a lesson about the way people buy things. In the Coaster Show, because there were 10, some people don't want to be the first person to break up a set, maybe.
Right.
So once somebody breaks up a set, they can be like, oh, okay, now I can buy these two that I like, you know. But there's also that feeding frenzy that goes into hype, you know, that once something starts to sell and people realize, well, oh, I like
great.
That.
Yeah, this must
yeah. be. But she's done really, really well. And I mean, I was listening to the interview that you did with her, you know, that great discussion. What a life, you know, like, what an incredible individual. And she does really, really well. And that's not easy to do. And it's not easy to do the way that she did it.
Right.
So, I mean, like, you know, that's, I have incredible respect, you know, for people who find a way in, you know, and it's not easy. You know, the art world is no different than most other industries where it's incredibly hard for anybody to make it in without going through whatever the quote unquote proper channels is, which of course costs a fortune, right, of, you know, going to the right school and getting the right master's degree and, you know, possibly getting a doctorate and then having a patron at that school that believes in you so that you get the right, you know, gallerist in the right neighborhood. And I mean, that's $500,000 later. You know, that's not enough. And most of those people fail, you know, most of the people that pay that $500,000, they go nowhere with it. So, you know, to not have that money, it's an outsider route in, you know, and I've got a lot of respect for gatecrashers. I've got a lot of respect for, you know, my favorite thing in the world is a prank. A good prank executed well is delicious. You know, it's like, I love those heist movies, like, you know, Ocean's 11 and stuff like that, you know, and when the plan doesn't work out, it's like, okay, yeah, that wasn't going to work. But, you know, if it's executed well, because that means the script is well written too, and that's an art form, you know, so it's like all these things have to fire on all cylinders. And so when you look at something like that, when you look at, you know, that show, we had a couple political pieces in there. We had a couple pieces that addressed COVID. Very few of them sold. I think it was too close to the, you know, to the groove, so to speak, you know, that a person wearing a COVID mask doesn't necessarily want to buy a painting of someone wearing a COVID mask. Right. You know, that, you know, we've been through 4 years of Donald Trump, and if you hate Donald Trump, you like that image, but it's fine to have on Instagram. You know, you don't need to bring it home. You don't really want to look at Trump's face all the time. And if you love Trump, you don't want to look at him that way. Right. So it's like, it's sort of like it splits the middle and pleases no one beyond the lulls. You know, it's the value of a lot of art these days. You used to say that, oh, you know, that painting was already, wasn't with the time, you know, he's painting out of step with the times. Now it's like, if you're in step with the times, you're in step with like the first 5 minutes of your opening, right. You know, like 10 minutes into that opening, almost nothing that's relevant is going to be relevant anymore. You know, that people will leapfrog on to the next thing. So the only thing you can hope to be is just a little too early, you know, that the society catches up with it, that the zeitgeist realizes that they missed something. And, you know, this is such a big part of being, you know, making it into that next level. Like, how do you get to the person who has never sold a piece of artwork, selling anything is great. It's validation. Someone cares enough about my work that they paid me money. Could be $60.
Right.
Could be 20. First piece of art I sold, I think, was 50 cents. And first piece I bought was 15. So, you know, there's a good transaction there.
It's funny. One of the first artists I interviewed, this guy, Brian Phillips, he talks about it. I think it's episode 10. But he loved wrestling as a little kid, and he used to draw wrestlers. And he was somewhere with his mom, and this woman walked by, and she noticed him sitting at this on the floor at this coffee table drawing wrestlers, and started asking him about it. The next thing you know, he was an illustrator for Georgia Championship Wrestling, which was kind of the predecessor to the WWF.
Yeah, that's like WWA, right?
Yeah, I mean, now it's WWE, I think. But yeah, I mean, that's
back then there was AWA. There were all these regional outfits. Yeah, yeah, I remember. I remember those days.
Yeah,
they all would come to the Boston Garden.
Yeah, yeah, and that was his break.
That's incredible.
That's the first, incredible. As a 10, 12-year-old kid, he got paid to draw wrestlers. Yeah. So listen, man, we could go on and on and on, but
true.
We're going to end up with 3 episodes here if we keep going. So, you know, looking back on your life, I mean, was there a time when you feel like you needed a word of advice or some support? And when would that have been? And what would you go back and say to the younger Matt?
When I was 19, I attempted suicide, and it was the culmination of a lot of different types of dissatisfaction. There was a lot of stuff that was beyond my control. There was a lot of stuff that was just bad decisions that I had made. And I really wish that, you know, that somebody would have recognized what I was going through at that time, that I could have been spared that. And I did learn from it. I didn't learn from it immediately. You know, it was, you know, you do something like that, you wind up at the hospital, you know, you're immediately, there's a process that happens. You know, if you have insurance, there's a process that happens. So again, even this is a privilege,
right?
You know, like, you know, being, you know, forced to stay in a hospital, you know, where they lock a door so you can't get out, is a part of that process. And, you know, and to have insurance to the point that they would keep me there for observation is a privilege that a lot of people don't have. And a lot of those people get let right back out on the street. And I was also a minor. So there was, you know, the things that you have to deal with, the stigma type of things that you have to deal with once you get home, of, you know, being in a household with parents that were a part of the problem, that are now, don't see this as something that they need to deal with, but that this new shame that you've now brought upon them. And I think that, you know, that it would have been good to have known going into that, that that was not a unique situation, that it was a situation that probably, I mean, maybe 60% of my classmates were going through similar stuff. Not one of the factors, which I won't get into, probably not. But, you know, that was something that took addressing over a longer period of time that I had to kind of come to grips with. It came very late in life. And, you know, I've dealt with it in my own way. You know, and different people deal with different things in different ways and need a different amount of time to do it. And I get that too. You know, it's in, while I've never kind of lingered on, emotions. And again, you know, we talked about that earlier. We grew up in a generation where we really weren't supposed to show much emotion. That became sort of a bottle for me. And that was a bad thing and a destructive thing. And I would have been nice to know that it was okay to show emotion when I was much younger, because I wouldn't have bottled it and it wouldn't have caused an explosion.
Yeah.
And so when I see somebody, I work with a lot of artists, and I work with a lot of artists who aren't necessarily successful, and some of them are extremely talented and they just don't catch the right breaks. You can give them the exhibition, you can show the work, and some other factor comes into play. Sometimes they didn't necessarily deliver the right paintings, and you figure that out over time, and you can probably get in there and you can tool that. But if they need money to live, you know, they can't stick to their guns and say, I'm not going to strip mine the price on my work.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to, you know, I can just keep doing this. Okay. You know, water off a duck's ass, as they say. So this becomes a real issue for them. So when I spot that stuff, I usually buy a piece from somebody because they need a sale, and
right.
It doesn't have to be a big sale. You know, it doesn't have to be enough to pay the rent. It just has to be validation.
Right.
And now, because it's me buying the piece, and, you know, I have a certain reputation, it's a higher form of validation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a validation that carries a certain amount of respect from their peers. And so that's a different type of validation that no other buyer can give them.
Mm.
And that may be all it takes to keep them from trying to do something foolish.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, because I've been through it and because I understand it, I think for a little while I was a bit cavalier about how other people dealt with pain, because I felt like I had a really quick bounce back. It's not the case at all. I had a quick bounce back in the way that it looked like I was back to normal and fine. And instead, I went for a very, very long time without really healing, without dealing with the core issues of why I tried to kill myself.
Right.
You know, and that came much, much later. And it was like, and when it happened, it was like, whoa, you know, like life altering, you know, crying nonstop for half an hour and so happy to do so, you know, just like so welcoming those tears and realizing that this was what I needed. This is what I had to think about it. I had to get rid of it. I had to let it go. It's finally gone. And you know, whenever I see something like that, I try to reach out. And there are artists that maybe I've only met in passing, or they're friends of friends, and I will occasionally reach out and be like, "Hey, man, are you okay?" And sometimes I think they're kind of like, "Why did he do that? Like, I barely know that dude." You know, and it's like, how come he's taking such an interest? And it's because I can see those signs, you know, like, yeah. I've been through it. Like, I can identify it. It's not hard when you've been there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's maybe just that intervention from somebody who's not so close to the problem is right. A good thing. It's, you know, I mean, not an authority.
We all need somebody who gives a shit.
Yeah.
That's really what it boils down to.
But it's also good if someone gives a shit who isn't vested in the outcome.
Right.
Because that's another thing. Because if you're in a dark spot, you may take, you know, the advice of a family member or a close person as well. Are they saying what's good for them because they'll be bummed out? You know, if I'm not here, is that a selfish thing? Or is this really what's good for me? And, you know, and so if there's somebody who is completely, you know, objectively removed from their immediate reality, who is able to identify, you know, that something may be off and willing to help, then again, it's a weird type of validation of like, how come that person cares about me?
Right.
Right. You know, and it's like, so I feel like anybody.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, one of the last thing I say at the end of every episode, if you listen all the way to the end, is be nice.
Yep.
You know, and that's a practice that I've developed over the last 5 or 6 years that, you know, I just refuse to live in a world where I don't say hello to the people who I cross paths with every day. I mean, yeah. I say hello to people. And yep. Something as small as that. Eye contact, hello, can really make a difference in yep. somebody's life. You know, I made eye contact with someone at the grocery store yesterday, and I could tell it made a difference, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, this has been great, man. I really appreciate it. And I hope that, you know, maybe you can pass along some of these artists to me, and I can help too. You know,
sure.
I mean, I'd like you to like try to keep your eyes open for, you know, somebody for me to talk to or, you know, and maybe we can do this again sometime. This is great. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. I appreciate you, man. This is a great show. I loved, you know, that first episode I heard. I went and dove into a couple more and I like those as well. And it's just a good format. And, you know, obviously you're coming at this from a really, really good place. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find The Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time. So I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.